Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of The Dissenter. I'm your host, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Hill. She is professor of psychology at the University of Detroit Mercy in the United States. Her primary areas of research interest focus on evolutionary and comparative psychology. She has investigated the interaction between biological and environmental factors in risk-taking behavior. In this research, she used evolutionary theory related to parental investment and life history strategies to conceptualize environmental factors, especially the impact of an unpredictable family environment. The areas of impulsivity, risky drinking, and risk-taking have been of most interest. So, Dr. Hill, thank you a lot for taking the time to come on the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm impressed that you and your listeners would be interested in these topics.
Oh, I'm all interested in these kinds of things. I mean, I've already had several different evolutionary psychologists on the show and people that work with evolutionary theory applied to human psychology and behavior. And so that's of interest to me and also to my listeners. So there's no problem there. So let me ask you first, because today we're going to talk a little bit about life history, parental investment, and the effects that some of those things have on particularly risky behavior, but I mean the behavior in general of adolescents mainly, and the repercussions that has in their lives. So the first question I would like to ask you is, what is life history theory about?
Well, it's a subset of evolutionary theory, and it focuses on the evolution of characteristics of lifetimes so that the lifetime itself is a variable and an outcome. And initially, it was developed to look at differences between species and species, particularly species that lived in environments that were stable versus environments that were variable or unpredictable, this kind of thing, so that you could explain differences in life cycles of elephants versus salmon or that kind of thing, or different kinds of salmon. So elements of the life cycle might be things like how long it takes to mature when you start having offspring, how long you live afterward, how many offspring, that kind of thing. When you die is a variable. So it's a newer approach to try to apply that to differences within species, but that started even with people, maybe 30 years ago, anthropologists looking at the huge variety of human beings and the environments that they are in and the patterns that they have in births and deaths and growth. That has been worked on more, but it's still a little, it's in process. It's still a little unclear exactly how it happens that people in the same species, even though there's all this variety, end up looking so different. For example, even in a city like Chicago or Detroit, if you look at different neighborhoods, the average lifespan there, maybe one neighborhood, it will be 55 years old. Maybe another neighborhood, it will be 77. So that's a 20-year span, and we usually don't think about things like that as being so variable. But then, if you look all over the world at other societies, you see even more variety in terms of that kind of aspect of of life.
So, as you were saying at the beginning, first people tried to apply life history theory in the sense of comparing different species and understanding if, for example, one species that evolved in a particular kind of environment had a faster or slower life history. And I guess that in our case as humans, we in general have slow-paced life histories in the sense that we have long periods of development, but then within species, and in this case particularly within our own species, because people are exposed to different environmental influences, for example, then there are variable life history strategies that people can adopt to deal with those conditions they are exposed to. Is that correct?
Well, I wouldn't put it in a way that it sounds so conscious, that people are consciously selecting.
Oh yeah, of course, not consciously, but
it's a shorthand way of talking about people's development. And I think a lot of our decisions and a lot of our behavior is largely unconscious, that we're not making rational decisions and laying out all the pros and cons of everything that we do, that it's more just immediate and reactive as a rule. But yes, human beings have very long lifespans in general compared to other primates that are closest to us, and we have different stages of development, particularly maturation takes a whole lot longer versus something like a chimpanzee. But yes, what you were saying is basically correct, that environments differ a lot in mortality patterns. What are the predators? Are the predators avoidable? Are the sources of food predictable? And are they seasonal? Are they how spread out are they? How much competition is there? How do you find them? So niches vary. Your ecological niches vary in all of those things. So when animals have become adapted, they can be very different. And particularly how dangerous the environment is thought to be the main factor that would affect how quickly you mature, how quickly you start reproducing.
And isn't it also the case that we have to take into account individual differences, like for example, differences at the level of personality? Because is it the case that as humans, when we are exposed to, for example, unpredictable environments, that we all, in general, tend to adopt fast life history strategies, or do we also have to take into account individual differences and how each person deals with the environment she is exposed to?
Well, that's an area of new research, which I am not doing. I'm trying to keep track of what's going on in that area, but there's a new area looking at something called differential susceptibility to the environment, and there are some collaborations of other researchers going on. For example, someone named Jay Belsky is a developmental psychologist who started thinking about life history theory and people 30 years ago, or 25 years ago. I'm not sure when he began thinking about it, but I think, is the first person who came up with this term differential susceptibility, where there may be some genetic factors or biological factors that influence how susceptible someone is to the environment when you're a child. And another person who's looking at this is Bruce Ellis, who's done a lot of work in unpredictability, also working in child development. So what both of them are looking at is variation among people, not in personality, but, or you, I don't know if you would call it personality, but physiology, particularly in terms of how reactive you are to stress. So this is part of the cortisol, hypothalamic, adrenal gland system, how reactive you are to stressful events. And some people are very moderate. They don't react much. Their heart rate doesn't go up. Their cortisol doesn't go up. Or if it does go up, it comes down quickly. Other people have a more pronounced response that keeps going. And apparently what can happen then is not necessarily bad. It can be either bad or good. But some people will be susceptible to that environmental influence, and some people will not, or will be less susceptible. So it makes it very difficult to figure out both what direction a change may be. Will it be that someone will be very reactive to positive things, positive influences, opportunities? That might happen. It also might happen that if you're in a bad environment, that you will have more and more effects of prolonged stress and the effects on your nervous system of stress hormones. So that's one thing that's a lot of research is going on right now, that it's not necessarily going to be known exactly what the reaction will be. Some people with a different physiology or genetic makeup may be less affected by the environment than others that are more sensitive. So the names that Bruce Ellis is giving to these different outcomes, one is the high reactivity, could be called on one extreme, vigilant. People who grow up vigilant, always on guard for negative things happening. And other people are sensitive. They could be called sensitive, but also sensitive in a very good way, in that they will be responsive to and take advantage of good opportunities. But what it may mean is that some people are going to be less responsive to the environment. And it's not going to be that there is maybe one personality or one or genes that we can find, but more how the stress response system is set up, something like that.
So, in your own work and while trying to understand behaviors like risk taking and different kinds of risk taking, what were the aspects or principles of life history theory that you applied?
Well, I was very struck by how ecologists looked at the environment from a very broad level, and how they looked at the predictability of resources and whether mortality risks could be avoided, and how the life history theory looked at parental investment in terms of how effective can it be? Now that sounds kind of cold thinking about human beings, but if you're looking at other animals, there may be times when parental investment is not going to make any difference. So if mortality is not avoidable and the investment is not beneficial, then if you're looking at a lot of animals, you see animals that don't have any parental care at all. You lay your eggs underneath the ground, or you put your eggs in the water, no parental care, because there's not anything you can do that is going to be an effective investment. So back to your question, at the same time, I had learned from biologists about more about the concept of unpredictability. And there was a biologist who was a student of Robert Trivers who came up with the conceptualization of parental investment and parent-offspring conflict. One of his students was named James Weinrich, and he wrote a paper, I think the first paper I saw that used unpredictability, trying to understand differences in people with different incomes and occupations, applying it to humans, and in terms of what he called, this was like 1977, what he called pair bonding, how a predictable income, predictable resources would relate to pair bonding or not. What will be the benefits of maintaining a pair to rear offspring, benefits or costs. So when I looked at human families, I tried to take these ideas about how ecologists look at the environment and see how are we looking at human environments in terms of these same aspects? Mortality, dangers, crime in the neighborhood, and predictability of resources with animals that would be food, with human beings. It would be in anything which would influence predictability of daily life. So it to me, those ideas from ecology and life history theory translated into human beings, predictability of the parental behavior, predictability of the home, even routines, even like the parents' behaviors toward the children, meal times, that kind of thing. Predictability of daily routines. So that predictability of daily routines would lead into beliefs or understandings about predictability of the world. I mean, that's the kind of a leap with human beings, that we have brains that develop schemas to understand the world, so we would be able to form a picture of the world as predictable, or even if you're an animal, to form a habit that the day is predictable, or from day to day, your habits will be similar. And I was working at the University of Michigan Alcohol Research Center, and I don't know if you have the same concept or description in your country, but at that time, 20 years ago, there was a way of describing families with alcoholic parents, parents who have problems with alcohol, as a family chaos. Family chaos, because the parents wouldn't be fulfilling their routines. They may be absent. They may spend their paycheck on alcohol, so that the life they may be unpredictably angry or abusive to the children. And the chaos concept reminded me of the unpredictability concept from life history. So, we're working with we call them postdoctoral fellows or a postdoctoral researcher named Lisa Thompson Ross at the Alcohol Research Center. We came up with the idea of looking at family unpredictability in people, stimulated by this idea of what happens in families with parents who have alcohol problems, because there really did seem to be chaos going on, that it wasn't just the parents were not doing very well and they were predictably poor, or not doing well in their jobs, or that they were mean all the time. It's that they changed from day to day, that they could change. So now I've gone on. I want to make sure I'm answering the question you actually asked. So
I mean, basically, I guess that what I was asking is, well, first of all, what are the kinds of things that render an environment or the environment where the child or the adolescent is developing in an unpredictable environment? I guess that you've already referenced or made reference to some of those things, but I mean, what distinguishes in terms of family dynamics, let's say, a predictable from an unpredictable environment?
Well, people will actually say that they keep changing their minds about the rules for their children, or they make a threat and then they don't carry it out, or they give different amounts of affection from one day to another. One day you go to your parent and they will be too irritated by you to care about your skinned knee. Another day, the next day you go and they're very concerned and warm. So one of those days they may be under the influence of a substance, and another day they may not, so that they are not giving you a consistent, warm response. And it's important for children to have, especially, some kind of predictable responsiveness of the parent to their needs. And if someone is under the influence of a substance, they may not care. It may not reach into their awareness that the child is uncomfortable or in pain or needs something. Another thing is the idea of the unpredictable meals or money, that simply that some months you can't pay the electric bill, some months you can't pay the gas bill, some bill collector shows up at your door. Another month you may have a lot of money. So it's the unpredictability aspect. On the meals scale, it's something like the questions we ask, like the same people sit down for dinner every night, or it's better if people get their own meals. And that's fine if you're teenagers, but not if you're younger. So the other thing, the unpredictable discipline, like sometimes when you do something wrong, you may get paddled or spanked. People don't do much paddling anymore, but spanked or punished. And then another time, nobody cares that you didn't go to school. So it's a difference. It's not that nobody cares all the time. That would be predictable, but that sometimes they care, sometimes they don't. So we thought that led to developing an idea of the world as very hard to understand and not predictable, and that because of that, the future would be ignored or blocked out. You wouldn't think about the future, and it wouldn't be understandable, and so it wouldn't be valued, that only the here and now would be valued. Mm-hmm. Now, that's putting that in a very rational or cognitive way, which, like I said before, I don't think that is how it operates. I think it's more just emotional. I think it's more of an emotional mechanism, which we don't really understand about why you do the things that you do.
And in what ways would those kinds of environments, of unpredictable environments, affect children's and older people's that older people that go through that kind of childhood at the level of their behavior?
Well, the way it would affect you is that you would not be thinking about the risks of your behavior. Mm-hmm. Every behavior has cost and benefits, and risk-taking has cost and benefits, and the consequences are either scary or just ignored. And depending on when the consequences might happen, if the future is ignored or not predictable, devalued, then you don't care about consequences that are in the future. So you also don't care about rewards that are in the future. So what that means is that rewards that are right now are more important than rewards in the future, because the future may not happen and you don't think about it. And also, consequences that are right now are more important than consequences that are in the future. So if you think you can get a benefit today, and again, I'm saying think, let's say if something will feel good today, mm-hmm. and the consequences are tomorrow, then it's going to be much more compelling to take that drink or go home with the person you don't really know, or drive the car because you might be able to drive even though you're under the influence. You might not get stopped by the police. So and then you might miss work tomorrow, but that's tomorrow. So it's the difference between what's right in front of you and what might happen tomorrow, but tomorrow is not important. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel important in the same way. To make it important, I think that people, our basic state is impulsivity. You know, mm-hmm. our natural state is impulsivity. If you look at children or, you know, other animals that we're related to, our basic state is impulsivity. It's not to plan ahead, mm-hmm. and it's not to think through all the consequences and their probabilities of every behavior. In order to delay gratification, we need to be trained. So we need to be trained to think about consequences and be afraid. And we need to be trained to elevate or enhance the future benefits so that we visualize them immediately and compare them to the pleasure that we would get immediately. It's difficult. People really need to be trained in order to do that. It's not, I don't think it's natural.
Mm-hmm. And do you think there's any particular reason for that, for the fact that you think that our basic state is the one of impulsivity? Is it because, for example, during most of our evolutionary history, we lived as hunter-gatherers and foragers, and so, for example, just to give an example, when it came to food, people hunted and gathered food, and basically because they wouldn't be able to preserve it, they had to consume all right away, or otherwise it would go rotten or something like that. And so, basically, do you think that could have had some influence in that basic state that we have, or?
Well, I think so, but I'm not an anthropologist. I don't want to presume to really know how our ancestors really lived before agriculture. But let's say we developed agriculture 10,000 years ago, maybe. I'm not even sure, but 10, 20,000 years ago, we developed agriculture, and we had to be able to predict the seasons anyway to predict when to plant the crops, when to grow, when they would be ripe, that kind of thing. And even before that, I think people figured out when the nuts would ripen, nuts on trees, when they would be ripe, when various plants would be ripe. Even though we didn't plant them from seeds ourselves, we could track when different fruits would ripen. So there had to be some, but I think in our ancestral past, when we get that far back before agriculture, I think it would have been very hard to plan ahead. And I think it's pretty recent that we can plan ahead very, very far. And I think it shows in that I don't think we're very good even now. Even people who have been trained to think about the future and plan ahead, it's still very hard for people to do that, even plan for their own retirement or plan for what is the planet going to be like 50 years from now. It's very hard to plan for the future.
And when you talk about risky behavior, what kinds of behavior are you referring to when people develop fast life history strategies? Is it about, for example, being more aggressive and violent and things related to crime? Is it about being more at risk of becoming an alcoholic or addicted to, I don't know, gambling or substance abuse or something like that?
Well, risky behavior is anything that threatens your survival. I think that's a way to look at it, in that refraining from taking a risk, you're buying survival. So it relates to the future because you're buying survival in the future, so you have to have value of the future. But risky behavior, when I think about it, or in the questions that we asked in our questionnaires, are things having to do with safety, sexual risk, social risk too. So you're risking your social reputation, which is very valuable to live in the world as a human being. Things like telling lies or calling in to work sick when you're not sick. So breaking rules, social rules that threaten your social reputation. And then safety risks are things like not wearing a seatbelt in your car, riding a motorcycle, driving while intoxicated, even things that seem like fun, like bungee jumping or parachuting, they're risky. So anything that's a physical risk like that, and then back to and getting into fights, physical fights, I wouldn't necessarily put crime in general into risk-taking because we were trying to get more at risks that are get at the safety. You're buying survival in the future versus something that's pleasurable right now. So the sexual risk would be things like unprotected sex, either so that you might get pregnant or you might catch a disease. So again, it's immediate pleasure versus future disability or problems in the future. So when I was doing this work, it was before people were in the life history area were starting to call these fast and slow life histories. So I tend more to think of it as trade-offs, you're trading off now versus later, benefits now versus benefits later, as opposed to grouping a lot of things together. I'm not sure I would group crime. Crime has many aspects to it, like white collar crime has many aspects to it that are very different from something like just getting angry and getting into a fight and not being able to control yourself. Some crime that could result in assault or manslaughter, whereas some crime is very deliberate. It's more like predatory behavior if you were looking at animals than it is the kind of aggression that would be in the risk-taking aggression, although it also can be very similar. And gambling can certainly fit into the risk-taking category, depending upon how impulsive and is it is as opposed to a business. So I always want to say it depends. Now, with drinking, there the category of risky drinking is very interesting, and it's a very interesting way to look at all this because if you drink, the usual cutoff is something like 5 ounces, 5 drinks for men will usually make you intoxicated, so that you are so a drink is a glass of wine, 5 glasses of wine, or 5 bottles of beer, or will usually make you intoxicated. So the idea is that you are losing your conscious control of what you're doing. And for many people, that is a risk because of how you may or may not behave. So risky drinking seems to follow the pattern of risk-taking in general, in that the most common demographic group that engages in it is young men. So it can entail a lot of positives, a lot of fun things if you're intoxicated. So there's positives now, but then there may be consequences later. So it's a very good example of risk-taking.
And it's interesting that you refer to the demographic of young men because, I mean, are there significant gender differences in terms of how people develop life history strategies?
I'm not sure there are differences in how they develop them, but there are gender differences in the outcomes. I recall from looking at your website that you talked to Martin Daly. Martin Daly, okay. He He and Margot Wilson, who has passed away, wrote a paper in a long time ago called the Young Male Syndrome. And they're using syndrome because there are a lot of risks that are practiced by young men, drinking, fighting, riding motorcycles, etc., that seem to cluster together. And their paper was about how the clustering at that age seems to relate to the age where there is competition for mates. So I haven't looked at the video when you talked to him, so I don't know if you touched upon that, but where there is competition and there are some losers and some winners, then there's more of a payoff for taking risks. So, in general, if there's more variability in the outcomes of one sex than another, the sex that's more variable will take more risks because you have more to gain. And there are some people who get totally pushed out of the competition. So in the past, it's less true today, but in the past there were it wasn't very common for women to have no children. Most women got married and had some children, but there were more men who had no children. They couldn't get married, they couldn't find a wife. And then there were some men who had more than one wife, so there was more variance. And through history, back to our ancestors, if that were the case, then there would be more advantages for men to take risks if it meant getting more resources or winning that wife or outcompeting the next man, as opposed to women who would be less variable, that it would be in general easier for women to have a mate, get married or whatever, have a pair bonded relationship. So there would be less advantages for women to take risks. The other thing that goes into that is once you have any kind of sexual division of labor in childcare, then there it will be not advantageous for women to take a lot of risk if they have children depending on them, so that women would be less likely to risk their lives because in the past the children may not have anyone else who will take care of them. So women would be less likely to get into fights where they might risk damage to themselves. They might actually risk dying. So we still have those aspects playing into our life histories, so that well, in one of the in some research that I did, people who are married take less risks. They drink less. I was particularly looking at risky drinking. So you can look at age and gender patterns and patterns of do you have children? And the risk-taking pattern seems to be that the risk-taking something like drinking is going to occur before people have children. And that's fortunate because, as I was just saying before, when parents have alcohol problems, they create an environment for the children that really is not very, very good. So now, in our contemporary society, there is more of a convergence of drinking patterns between men and women. You see more women doing risky drinking. And so that's changing a little bit, just as women's lives are changing in general. Drinking is going along with it. So I haven't looked at statistics about things like getting into fights or how many women are getting into fights. That would be a big change if you saw more women getting into fights, because that used to not happen, except maybe for 17-year-old, 15-year-old adolescent girls, maybe, looking at the statistics. So you still see differences in ages and genders in the patterns of risk taking. I think what happens is early in development, which was the question that you originally asked, that women are very much trained to be cautious and to avoid risks, and that's still true. Slightly less than it used to be, but it's still true that women are much more trained to try not to get hurt or do things that are dangerous. And so we'll continue to see these patterns in risk taking as long as that's the case. I think that there probably is a gender difference that relates to a biological difference. I'm not sure how much that is. What usually happens with human behavior is we like to stereotype. Mm-hmm. So there probably is a small difference that's due to biology, a small difference in propensity to take risks. And I think what we do is we with our training, we make that bigger, mm-hmm. by training women to be afraid and be cautious and not take risks. So what starts out maybe as a small difference, and it becomes a large difference, and it becomes something that we stereotype people on. So now men have to take risks, women can't take risks. So we've spread apart men and women in a way that something seems very like a strong difference, when it's not necessarily unchangeable. It might look unchangeable, and it might look biological, but it's a lot of it might be training.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you don't think that it would be fair for us to say that men in general are more biologically predisposed toward risky behavior?
Well, I'm not sure I would argue against the predisposition. Mm-hmm. You know, there may be a predisposition that men would, I guess what I would struggle with is what is the shape of the predisposition. Let's say it's testosterone. You know, then that having testosterone early in development may change the brain a little bit, so that something that seems risky, like I'm going to go to the bar and have a drink, and then maybe when this guy I don't know insults me, maybe I'll punch him. What the testosterone may do may make your system a little more responsive to something that seems rewarding. So there's maybe a little change in the brain. So the reward seems a little more rewarding than without having that exposure to testosterone when you were in fetus, let's say. And it might make a reaction a little bit stronger to somebody insulting you than otherwise. But that, you know, that propensity can either be trained and fostered and encouraged, or it can be discouraged. You know, let's say if that were a woman, who a woman would have had a lifetime of being cautioned against, you know, don't go out by yourself, don't stay out late, you know, don't get drunk, you know, don't even take a drink, somebody else might put something in, etc. And then, you know, don't fight back, you know, get out of there. So the difference between a feeling, I mean, let's say you have a slight physiological difference, and then that translates into a difference in a feeling. It's very far from a difference in behavior. The other thing about all of these physiological differences, or what we might call a propensity, is that they all have a normal distribution. So let's say your propensity to feel anger, or your propensity to feel happy at the thought of that ice cold beer, that has a normal distribution. So there's a lot of people in the middle, and there are people on the edges who have more, who have less. And whenever we talk about sex differences, there's those normal distributions overlap, so that there might be a difference. I'm holding my hands up here. There might be a difference. Men and women, the average might be somewhat different, but then there's a lot of women who might feel more than a lot of men. Mm-hmm. So what we tend to do as people is to turn that difference in the averages into a stereotype. Mm-hmm. And then we think if a woman feels a way that doesn't fit the stereotype, that she's abnormal. So I always try to be careful whenever we say there's a gender difference, just to say that, because it's usually a difference of quantity, you know, not a difference like there's a whole, it's not like we're different species, but there's a quantity difference, and it's important to, I guess, understand that there's a whole range in both sexes, so that if there's a man, you know, who doesn't want to fight, who wants to, you know, run away, don't fight, then that's understood. That it's not that that man is a chicken, you know, but that's a response. It's a defensive response in a situation that, you know, it fits the normal distribution. Mm-hmm. So let's not be, sometimes it leads to discrimination or prejudice against people who are off the average. They're not on the average. So they're abnormal. I mean, technically, statistically, they're abnormal, you know, but that's just saying that statistically. But it's hard as human beings, we want to categorize things. We want to have categories, and we don't, it's hard to understand the whole range is there and is normal.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's very well put, I think. And but could it be the case that there could be some differences in terms of the specific types of risky behavior that are more frequent in men and women? I mean, not risky behavior in general, but if we were to break it down into several different categories of risky behavior, then maybe men would be more predisposed to exhibit certain types and women other types. I don't know.
Well, I haven't really thought about that enough, I don't think. I think somebody like Martin Daly, maybe, He might be able to. I think something like the fighting, I think, is a good candidate for differences between the average man and the average woman because of differences in the cost and benefits of fighting. For men in many situations, you have to compete. You have to compete with other men. So, however you need to do it, physical fighting or verbal, I think that's probably a good candidate. And also historically, looking at the statistics for women fighting, it's not been a frequent thing. Now, of course, you have women boxers. We have a Olympic boxing champion from Michigan, the same state. So there you go. It's not, we're talking about averages. We can say on average you would expect something to be different, but you can always find an exception.
Okay, so Dr. Hill, I'm starting to get mindful of your time, so let's end the interview here. But just before we go, would you like to tell people what would be some of the best places on the internet or elsewhere for them to learn more about your work?
Well, actually, I had a thought. I was going to tell you that the scale that Lisa Thompson Ross and I created, called the Family Unpredictability Scale, has I see it has been translated into Portuguese, and that there are researchers at the University of Coimbra. You know that? That have used this. I don't know if you know them, but maybe you could look up their work. Teresa Sousa Machado and Jose Silva are looking at family unpredictability in studies in Portugal. So thought that would be interesting. The research that I've done, the only place on the internet to find it is on ResearchGate. There's a website called ResearchGate.net, and that's where I have listed the papers, and you can make requests there for copies of the papers if they're not already up there. The other thing that I probably should say is that I probably should say these are my personal opinions and not the opinions of my university. The University of Detroit Mercy wouldn't endorse them in any way. We have academic freedom, so I'm free to have any kind of opinions or do any research that I want. And then the other place you could find research like this would be the research society called the Evolution and Human Behavior Society, and they have a website. I don't remember the website, but it's Human Behavior and Evolution Society. That's a very good resource for different people who are working on looking at human behavior from an evolutionary perspective.
Okay, very good. So I will be leaving all of that in the description box of the interview, Dr. Hill. And also, thank you for referring to those two Portuguese researchers. I will certainly look them up. And again, thank you a lot for taking the time to come on the show. It was a real pleasure to have you on.
Well, thank you for being so informed and asking such good questions.
Hi everybody, thank you for watching this interview until the end. As you might have noticed, I've started this channel in February 2018 and have been putting out regular interviews with academics and intellectuals from a variety of fields. To keep the channel sustainable, I would like to ask you to please visit my Patreon page and to consider making a pledge there. If you don't like Patreon, you also have the alternatives of Subscribestar and PayPal. All of the links are in the description box of the video. Otherwise, and if you like what I'm doing, please share it, leave a like, and hit the subscription button. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my patrons, Karen Litzke, Anne Blanchett, Perel Galarsen, Lau Guerreiro, Santel Gelinas, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunde, Brian Rivera, Lucas Stafinia, Sergio Gondriano, Janne Eninen, Ricardo Vladimiro, Craig Healy, John Connors, Adam Castle, Vega Giddy, Doctors Jerry Muller, Herbert Gintis, Rutger Voss, and Bo Weingard, and also my three producers, Izar Webb, Rosie, and Jim Frank. Thank you for all.